This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, the IMF and World Bank hold meetings in Washington, plus earnings from J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington. So who is next on the hot seat on Capitol Hill?
I'm Jessica Summers in New York, where we're taking a deeper look at the impact of California's mass power outages on industries from winemaking to refining.
I'm Roger Hearing.
And I'm Caroline Hepke in London, where we're looking at how Greece set off the Eurozone crisis that began 10 years ago.
And in Asia, Chief Executive Carrie Lam delivers her annual policy address in Hong Kong. Does it satisfy protesters? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the global growth picture ahead of annual meetings of the World Bank and IMF in Washington this week. Let's get a preview now with Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist with Bloomberg Economics. And Carl, a little more gloomy?
I think that's going to be the case when we get the updated forecasts in the World Economic Outlook. In July, when they updated their forecasts, they highlighted that global growth remains subdued. And they talked about risks being mainly tilted to the downside. And all of those risks that they alluded to back in July have only gotten gloomier.
Here they come.
So I think we'll continue trending in that direction. And that means that overall growth will be revised down for 2019. And probably we'll see some downgrading of forecast for next year as well.
So that's not just globally. That's also right here at home, right?
Absolutely. So to me, it looks like the forecast they have for U.S. growth for this year, 2.6%, is a little bit too optimistic. My team's considerably lower than that. We're at about 2.3%, 2.3. So that means just downgrading the U.S. alone is going to lead you to a lower outcome, particularly as you look at the forecast for the developed economies. But also, I suspect that Germany, which our Europe team expects is potentially on the cusp of a technical recession, those forecasts may have been too rosy, as gloomy as they were back in July. And the same thing is true for the UK, with Brexit looking ever more a reality, if not at the end of October, in relatively short order. Our UK team thinks that Brexit, a hard Brexit, will lead to a recession there as well. So I think there's capacity for significant downgrades across the board, and what's happening in developed economies will certainly spill over into emerging market economies as well.
You sling all this stuff at me. It begins to sound not just a little bit gloomier, but a little more worrisome.
Well, as we slow down, whether we're looking at the U.S. economy or the global economy, when an economy is growing at a slower pace, it is more vulnerable to exogenous shocks, whether it's political, geopolitical, or commodity prices, oil prices, or any other shock for that matter. So that does, I don't think that the recession risks have increased appreciably for the U.S. economy. And that should be a beacon of good news amid all the gloominess that I've shed regarding the outlook. I think that the U.S. is growing more slowly, but still solidly perched to avoid tilting into a recession. And if the U.S. is doing okay, then that's at least some reason for optimism for a lot of those economies that are exporting into the U.S.
Now, when you mention exogenous shocks, I have to ask you, we're heading into an election year in the U.S. How concerning is that, given that the markets hate uncertainty, the economy is questionable?
Well, in the shorter run, so certainly elections have consequences, and that could lead to pretty significant shifts if we're talking, you're looking at who the potential front runners are at this point in time. The difference between the White House turning blue versus staying red is pretty consequential in terms of regulation, taxation, corporate profit trends, attitudes towards trust busting and whatnot. So there could be some real consequences after the election. In the meantime, however, in the current political climate, it looks like gridlock is far and away the most likely outcome between now and the election. Maybe there'll be some modest progress made on NAFTA 2.0, maybe getting passed, but I don't think we should expect much beyond that of any consequence.
What are some of the things we should be looking at outside the U.S. as it relates to the global economy?
Sure. Well, as we look at the developed economies, of course, Germany, an export powerhouse, is really struggling in a slower growth climate. So watching for signs of an intensifying downturn in Germany, possibly spreading more broadly through Europe, is a real problem. European policymakers don't have a lot of capacity to really provide stimulus to the economy outside of the fiscal realm. The ECB largely has its hands tied in terms of what it can do to stimulate growth. Looking a bit further east, certainly there's signs of slowing activity in China. To the extent that we can trust the data we're looking at, we have to be very cognizant that China could be heading for a sharper slowdown than what may otherwise be reported in the data. And looking further east still to Japan, Japan recently passed through a sales tax increase, which in prior episodes where they tried to push that through, it had somewhat disastrous consequences, tilting the economy into contraction. And so we'll be watching for leading indications that, is third time a charm for Japan, or have they stumbled yet again?
Our thanks, I think, to Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we'll preview third quarter earnings from some of the nation's banking giants. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Let's turn to U.S. bank earnings. More than half a dozen lenders report third quarter revenues in the coming week amid a choppy trading environment and IPO disappointment. Let's get the details now with Allison Williams, senior banking analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Allison, welcome. So Tuesday is the big day, huh?
Tuesday's the big day, and we have four of the big banks as well as the biggest asset manager, BlackRock, reporting. So it's a little unique that we'll be getting so many companies at once. I think from an investor's perspective, sometimes it's tougher to dig through all those numbers and get a read quickly. But the good thing is you'll be able to sort of tell right out of the gate, if you will, you know, who's doing better or worse. So is it, are the results indicative of an industry trend, or is it one bank better executing than another?
Now, what is your focus going to be this time around?
So like most analysts and investors following banks, you know, top of mind is the interest rate environment and what is the outlook for 2020. But I think with earnings, we're not going to get much on that front. I think that's going to wait till November and December investment conferences where we'll have a better look, just because things remain very dynamic. So our focus is really going to be two things. One, the cost front, where banks really need to deliver and what they're thinking about in terms of levers in the uncertain environment. Citigroup is a key one to watch there. Also Wells Fargo, but with the new CEO coming in there, most people do expect that things will be rebased. So it's a little less important for them this particular quarter. And then the second aspect is market share. So as I said, when we think about mitigation in a tougher environment, we think about what are the market share opportunities. JP Morgan is a company that's been gaining global investment bank market share. They've also been gaining against regional competitors. Can that continue? And then Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Goldman has been doing better this year in certain businesses. Can that sustain? Morgan Stanley has trailed a few quarters. I think any given quarter, nothing to get too upset about. But if it continues as a trend, then it becomes something to watch.
What do these banks have to look at to improve their market share?
So the biggest story this quarter is just going to be the exit of Deutsche Bank from several businesses. So Deutsche Bank has said that they are stepping out of equities. Initially, it sounded like a broad retreat. It's still a little unclear how much of the business that they're keeping. but they have sold off pieces of their business. So that's going to be benefiting some of the U.S. peers. So we're going to look for, you know, who's getting parts of that in equities. But then also, are there knock-on effects to Deutsche Bank's businesses? Are the banks gaining fees? And then the equity business, as you alluded to earlier, you know, so we had at least one high profile canceled deal. We have some things evolving overseas with the Saudi Aramco deal. So we're watching that as that evolves. But I think the question for the investment banks is, you know, as we head into 2020, what does that equity fee outlook look like? Just given some of the trends and pricing.
Our thanks to Allison Williams, Senior Banking Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Let's head to the commodity space for the week ahead now. And for that, we bring in Bloomberg's Jessica Summers. Jessica.
Bob, this week, more than 500,000 homes and businesses in Northern California lost power. Utility giant PG&E carried out its biggest ever intentional blackout to prevent high winds from knocking down electrical lines and igniting wildfires. Bloomberg's power and renewables reporter Mark Chediak joins me from San Francisco to talk about the impact of the blackouts on industries ranging from winemaking to refining. Great to have you, Mark. It seems like as California's climate warms and dries, these massive blackouts may start to occur more consistently each year. What sort of economic impact might the blackouts cause both now and in the future if they do continue to occur?
Yeah, these impacts are actually quite widespread, from businesses closing to workers' lives basically being upended. Some companies have to shell out for costly backup power generators just to keep their operations running. For instance, some local grocery stores have been doing this to make sure their produce is fresh and keep their food from spoiling. Others have backup generation just to keep their doors open. The estimated economic impact of PG&E's blackout, if it lasts for 2 days, is about $2.4 billion, and that's according to Michael Wehra, who's a energy and climate professor at Stanford University. That number would obviously rise the longer people are without power.
Wow. I also want to talk about the impact on key industries in California, like winemaking. I know some winemakers are planning to let grapes hang longer on the vines during the blackout. What will this lead to? And more generally, are winemakers able to weather a situation like this, widespread blackouts?
Well, that's interesting you bring up the what some winemakers are doing in terms of the grapes. I think the Napa Valley winemakers are trying to find a silver lining here for their predicament. They say some winemakers have had to put grape picking on pause due to the power outages. But that isn't really a bad thing because the weather right now is cool and sunny, so it's kind of ideal for the grapes. So the grapes can stay on the vines a little bit longer and actually, they say, can develop even a bit more complex flavor. So that's their take on the situation in regards to picking. In terms of harvesting the grapes, a lot of winemakers have lined up backup generators or have access to facilities that have one. So while this has been an added expense for them and will hurt their bottom line, it does allow them to continue their work during this critical harvest season.
Interesting. And many oil refineries also operate in California, and there are big networks of oil and refined product pipelines that run through the state. What's the expected effect on the energy industry, and how might it have to adapt if these blackouts do become more common?
That's a good question. So far with this blackout, the impacts have been minimal. All the refineries in the area say they remain in operation. Refineries also, they typically do have their own source of power on site in case the grid does go down. However, with this blackout, there is a fuel pipeline that travels throughout the state that has had to shut because of the blackout. And the impact of that remains to be seen. The other issue with the energy infrastructure is gas stations cannot pump fuel if they don't have power. We are getting reports that most stations in the area do have electricity, so that's not a huge concern right now. However, if you had a blackout that's even more widespread than this current one, getting fuel could end up being a real, real big problem.
That's definitely true. Mark, thank you so much for joining me and keeping us updated on this situation. This is one of the topics we're watching in commodities for the week ahead. In New York, I'm Jessica Summers. Bob?
Thank you, Jessica. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items are set to top the political agenda in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Up later in our program, nearly a decade has passed since the Greek government announced its economy was in serious trouble and the Eurozone debt crisis began. We head to Europe for the breakdown. But first, let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda next week. And for that, we bring in Bloomberg's Amy Morris.
Bob, President Trump's ambassador to the European Union has been subpoenaed to testify to House investigators as part of that impeachment inquiry. And sources tell Bloomberg News Gordon Sondland, who was scheduled to testify on Tuesday to Foreign Affairs, Intelligence and Oversight and Reform Committees, was blocked by the State Department. So this subpoena is for a closed door session in the coming week. We're going to find out more about this and other issues with Bloomberg News Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter. Kathleen, thank you for taking the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, first things first, you think he's really going to be able to testify this time?
Well, it certainly has been a drama-packed back and forth over whether or not he's going to be able to talk. And I think it probably will happen this time because his lawyers have essentially said that this is what they've worked out with the committee to comply with the subpoena. I think it's worth noting that the statement from his lawyers says that he will appear behind closed doors, but that he isn't able to turn over some of the documents that the committees have been seeking because those documents belong to the State Department and would be only the State Department would be the only ones that are able to turn it over, not Sondland himself. And so I think that's an interesting wrinkle to keep track of as well.
What do they hope to learn?
Well, so Gordon Sondland is someone whose name kind of became part of the Washington lexicon after Kurt Volker, who was the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, testified to these House impeachment panels. And essentially, following Volker's testimony, there was a document dump that included some text messages that Sondland either sent or was mentioned in. And so long and the short of it is that basically he's someone that's now been kind of tagged as a person who may have worked on some of these efforts to urge Ukraine to launch an investigation of the Bidens in exchange potentially for getting the release of military aid.
You know, Energy Secretary Rick Perry has also been subpoenaed. Was that at all a surprise for you?
In some ways, yes, because, you know, he is leaving the administration and he's someone that's been a Trump loyalist pretty much all along. However, you know, it's not surprising when you think about Trump in one of his many explanations and many of the things he said, many different things about this call and how it came about and, you know, what was said during it. One of the things he said as a by way of an explanation or even a defense was that he made the call at the behest of Perry. And so I think, you know, while that doesn't necessarily address what was actually said in the call, it stands to reason that the investigators would want to get a fuller picture of what went on there.
Okay, let's go back to the campaign and how President Trump has gone into full campaign mode. He was in Minnesota on Thursday night, but now there's some question about whether networks are going to continue to carry these big, raucous Trump rallies.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on here. One is back in 2016 or even 2015, you know, when Trump first launched his campaign, there was kind of the novelty factor, you know, that so the things that were happening at Trump rallies, it felt like there was really a moment happening. And the type of rhetoric that Trump was using and the types of things that would happen there were really, you know, unheard of, kind of hadn't really happened before, at least in, you know, television history. And so people were, I think, very intrigued by that. And that led to a lot of the coverage. And then also, I think after Trump was elected in 2016, there was kind of a reckoning among, you know, news organizations that went back and kind of second, you know, did a second Monday morning look at what had gone on. And really, I think the sense was that they gave a lot of free airtime to Trump. And so I think now that the novelty is worn off a bit and there's a sense that perhaps Trump got an unfair advantage out of the coverage he did get, I think that there's a push to, or the bar has just become higher. So they're not covering as much of what he does.
I see. They were covering it more not because of the news content, but because he might say something outrageous. Now they're really focusing on whether there's some actual news content there.
Absolutely. That's precisely it. And I think that, you know, Trump saying out, I think also just as, you know, an addendum to that, Trump saying outrageous things is no longer necessarily news in and of itself, because we're, you know, 3 years into his presidency and he says outrageous things, you know, pretty much daily.
And I can't let you get away. We are coming up against the clock, but I have to ask you about the Democrats debate coming up on Tuesday night. Your thoughts?
It'll be so interesting, really, to see what, if any, attention this Ukraine matter gets from the other candidates as it pertains to Joe Biden. I think there's been the message has come down strongly from the DNC that there's no help in attacking Biden, because if he becomes the nominee, then he's just weakened. But it'll be interesting to see if the other Democrats hold to that.
All right, Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bloomberg News Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter, and that's what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. Now, you can catch more of our political coverage weekdays on Bloomberg Balance of Power from noon to 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thank you, Amy. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam presents her annual policy address. We'll have the preview next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Wednesday will mark 10 years since the Greek government announced its economy was in serious trouble and the Eurozone debt crisis began. For more on what happened and the lessons learned, let's head to Europe and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchors Caroline Hepker and Roger Hearing.
Bob, a decade ago, the then Prime Minister George Papandreou said his nation faced unprecedented fiscal derailment. The Eurozone debt crisis followed, leading to widespread austerity, a collapse in investor confidence, and a string of multi-billion euro bailouts by the EU, the ECB and the IMF.
Well, for more on the events and what's changed since, we're joined now from Athens by Bloomberg reporter Paul Tugwell and here in London by David Powell, senior euro area economist for Bloomberg Economics. Paul, let me start with you. First of all, take us through what happened on October the 16th, 2009.
Yes, October the 16th was actually the first time that, as you said, the then Prime Minister George Papandreou gave a speech in Parliament. It was not obviously not long after he was elected in a landslide victory. A landslide victory in part because he had promised to boost pensions and boost wages. But in that speech, he announced to lawmakers, as you rightly said, that the country was facing a fiscal derailment without precedent, which nobody was expecting to hear. And indeed, Greece was facing its first contraction in 16 years at that time, as the global recession was hitting two of the country's biggest industries, tourism and shipping. So in that context, Papandreou pledged in Parliament to cut debt and to trim a budget deficit that at the time was thought to be around three times bigger than the European Union limit, whilst promising to boost wages and pensions through a 3 billion euro stimulus package. And of course, all of that now seems ironic, given that the following year he made Greece's request for its first bailout package.
Yeah, it was an absolutely shocking time, wasn't it, here in Europe? David, looking back on that time, though, a decade later, what do you think was the fundamental problem with the Greek economy?
Well, the fundamental problem with Greece was that just that it spent too much money. So when Greece joined the euro area, interest rates on Greek government bonds went way down, like they did all over the euro area. And Greece took advantage of that to go on a debt-fueled shopping spree. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was really hidden from investors because they used a number of accounting tricks to hide the real state of Greek government finances.
And Paul, when the EU and the ECB and the International Monetary Fund all came together to respond to this at various stages, was what they were doing effective from the Greek perspective?
I think that would very much depend on who you speak to. A general view, if I put it that way, overall, which would encompass general population and economists and politicians, looking back from where we are now, is that a lot was done by the three institutions that financially helped Greece. that dealt with some of the structural problems and some of this overspending that David mentioned, Greece basically living beyond its means. But some of the austerity measures and requests from the creditors was too much of a shock in too small a space of time, and it didn't give the country time to work through those problems. Of course, things are better now, and some people say, well, at the end of the day, maybe the requests and the response of the creditors was effective. But at the time, certainly, there was some anger and resentment towards the country's creditors.
It's fair to say, surely, also, the Troika was loathed in many parts of Greece. Certainly, you know, I remember the kind of the riots, the demonstrations that there were around that time. David, though, what do you think the wider implications are, looking back on it now, for the Eurozone? I mean, it was a critical time, wasn't it? Greece was either going to stay in the Eurozone or it was going to fall out of the European area. It was a real battle of wills at the time.
Yeah, the real implication for the Eurozone was that it caused investors to take a look around and to reassess the creditworthiness of all the countries in the euro area, because this reminded investors that these countries, unlike, say, the United Kingdom and the United States, didn't have their own central bank. And in the time of crisis, it couldn't necessarily be counted on to bail them out. And investors became worried not only about countries that had spent too much money, like Greece, but they also worried about countries that had been more fiscally responsible, such as Ireland and Spain, but they had housing busts and troubled banking sectors that could immediately become problems of the state if the state had to bail out those banking institutions.
Thank you so much for joining us. That is our Bloomberg reporter, Paul Tugwell from Athens, and here in London, David Powell, senior euro area economist for Bloomberg Economics.
I'm Roger Hearing in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Caroline and Roger. Let's turn to Asia now, where Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is set to give her annual policy address amid violent protests and recession risk. Let's get the details with Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Doug Krisner and Brian Curtis.
Bob, a big day coming up in Hong Kong on Wednesday as Chief Executive Carrie Lam delivers her annual policy address. We expect to hear more about plans to increase spending here, particularly on housing and social welfare. Will it help address the unrest that we've seen in Hong Kong? And will Ms. Lam announce anything of substance about universal suffrage? Doug and I asked Bloomberg's cross-asset reporter Eric Lam to join us for some discussion. So, Eric, the new spending would come at a time that you would think that it's really needed. The economy contracted in the second quarter and probably will have contracted in the third when it's all said and done as well.
Yeah, the policy address, you know, obviously everyone's looking forward to seeing what she's going to be able to come up with in terms of spending, because as you point out, Hong Kong's economy most likely did fall into a recession in the third quarter. Now, the issue here, and what I've come up with this in discussions with economists repeatedly about this issue, is that, you know, when you're trying to address the protesters, the protest is primarily a political issue, according to analysts, economists, professors. A lot of the economic issues for Hong Kong, especially the underlying deep-seated issues, those are separate issues that, you know, are more likely to be able to be addressed by things like spending. So the opinion is that if Carrie Lam announces any kind of spending measures, if they're short-term measures like what they usually do with sweeteners, that's not necessarily going to do anything to address what the political demands are from the protesters. The long-term issues that affect where some of those political demands are coming from, the underlying issues about housing that you're talking about the social welfare aspects, those things, those are long-term spending aspects that, again, the expectation is that the impact from that is not necessarily going to be apparent overnight. So again, it's not necessarily going to be something that's going to be able to solve the current protests right away either. So Carrie Lam's a bit of a rock and a hard place here, because the actual moves that they're able to make are limited. The actual things that they can spend on are fairly limited in terms of the immediate impact as well.
Huge capital reserves here in Hong Kong. They do have a lot of money. This is a rich government, run a budget surplus most of the time and have done so for a long, long time. Yet we have a shortage of nurses, a shortage of doctors, long waits for public hospitals, long waits for public housing. Isn't it time for the government to spend more?
Well, you know, that's something that's pundits have said repeatedly over the years. And, you know, we've watched that fiscal reserve
grow. But
this
has laid the ground for all the discontent that you see in the community. It's true that it's political. They want an advancement of universal suffrage and such, but people are angry for other reasons as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some of the issues you're talking about with public housing, that's a recurring problem. And if you look back in Hong Kong's history, you know, if you go back to the 1960s, people were protesting about similar things. You know, there was a lack of public housing back then as well, and the Hong Kong government embarked on a very ambitious 10-year spending scheme in the 60s and 70s to try to address those public housing issues. And, you know, 50 years later, we're still dealing with the same kinds of problems with a lack of housing in Hong Kong. So, you know, a lack of foresight, maybe a lack of political will. Those are certainly elements of it. A very common criticism for the Hong Kong government is that every year they announce those little sweeteners, they call them. You know, they'll give you a break on your tax bill, or maybe they'll give you credits for secondary school students or something. Those are short-term solutions that really don't solve any of the underlying issues that you're talking about. And, you know, we haven't seen that kind of will up till this point. Maybe we will see that this week. They've certainly got the impetus now for it.
I'm curious about the extent to which the protests have dampened tourism. Have we seen a meaningful drop in the level of tourism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, name your economic indicator, and all of them have been flashing red for the last few months. You know, if you go down the list, you take a look at visitor arrivals from mainland China, the number dropped something like 40% year on year in August. We just saw a record drop in retail sales value of 23% in the most recent reading. If you walk down the street in Hong Kong, you'll see shops are closing, or they're shutting down early, or they're just shuttered. You know, you don't have any kind of foot traffic other than really the protesters that are on the street, and they're not buying anything. We're not getting the mainland visitors that we usually do that, you know, buy all the products from the luxury shops.
Eric, thank you so much. Pleasure to have you on the program, and great to benefit from your insights. Bloomberg's cross-asset reporter, Eric Lam, and we'll have special coverage of Carrie Lam's policy address Wednesday here on Daybreak Asia. I'm Doug Krisner along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Doug and Brian. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.